From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Brian Steidel, a former Marine captain who worked with the African Union team in Darfur that was monitoring crimes against humanity. After about 6 months, he left Sudan in frustration over the African Union's lack of resources and its narrow mandate, which was to report on crimes but not to intervene. Then we talk with John Prendergast, who has worked on conflict resolution in Africa for 20 years and is an advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. We'll discuss the history behind the crisis in Darfur and why the UN Security Council has yet to reach an agreement on what to do about it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Brian Steidel, was a witness to crimes against humanity in Sudan. He's a 28-year-old former Marine captain who worked as an operational advisor to the African Union monitoring team in Darfur from last September to early February. He traveled with the team as they investigated violations of the ceasefire in Darfur. He first went to Sudan working with a private contractor hired by the U.S. State Department to monitor the ceasefire between the government in Khartoum and the rebels in the south, who had been in a civil war for over 20 years. That same private contractor later offered Steidel the position to work with the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. He left Darfur after several months, frustrated by the African Union's lack of resources and its narrow mandate, which was to report on crimes but not to intervene. Steidel decided he would be more effective describing what he witnessed to American legislators and to the American people. I asked him to describe one of the times he arrived with the monitoring team at a Darfur village during a massacre. Tell us about one of the times you arrived while a massacre was in progress.
I would have to say that the village of Labado, it was a village of 20,000 people. And the attack had happened the previous night and through into the morning. And we'd arrived in the morning, and I was standing there at the edge of the village with a Sudanese general who's in charge of the government forces and the Janjaweed forces that were there. We estimated there were maybe 4,500 total between the government and the Janjaweed. And we were standing at the edge of this village of 20,000, and it was burning in front of us. And there were, the Janjaweed were coming in from left to right and loading up their pack animals, horses, camels, donkeys. And then heading back out to the left and stacking it in huge piles and dividing up all of the loot. The village was being burnt in front of us. There were shots being fired in front of us. We could not see who they were shooting at because the village is so large and we were only on one side of it. But we wanted to enter to one, see what was going on, to get firsthand evidence. Two, to see if there were any injured people in the village that we could try to get out and get back to medical help. But we were unable to go in. The general had told us that he couldn't guarantee our safety if we had gone into the village, and that if we'd gone in the village, that most likely we would have been shot.
You mean he was telling you that if you went in, his men would kill you?
He didn't state it as directly as that, but yes, that's what we believed. Maybe not his men directly, but the Janjaweed forces that were in there. We don't differentiate between the government and the Janjaweed. It was, the Janjaweed and the government are the same. It's just having two different units. An army group that has, one group of regular army soldiers and one group of special forces soldiers, and they'd be working together on a certain operation. Where they're unarmed, and he says something like that, and there's nothing that we can do. We say, okay, well, we're not going to go in there. We tried to talk to him, and I specifically asked him. I said, what's your mission? He said, well, my mission is to protect the civilians and to open up this road so the commercial traffic can travel on it. And I said, well, I don't understand then. These guys, surely they're yours, so why don't you stop them? He said, well, they're not my guys. Those aren't my guys. I said, that guy is. Surely that guy is. He's in military uniform. And he says, no, he's not mine. He's not mine. And a vehicle pulls out of the compound behind us, and it drives around to the left, and it enters the village. And I said, surely these soldiers are yours. He said, yes, those are mine. They're going to fetch water. The vehicle stops 75 meters in front of us. Soldiers dismount. They go into a hut. They loot the hut. They burn the hut, and they continue. I said, those are your soldiers. Why don't you stop them? He said, oh, they're not my soldiers. So they continuously change the story as things go on.
Had you ever encountered that kind of arrogance of power before, where someone could just tell you this complete bold-faced lie, and everything you're witnessing proves it's a lie, but he's got the power and he can keep lying and there's nothing you can do about it? Was this your first time experiencing something like that?
No. Every single time that we interviewed one of the government commanders, the government of Sudan commanders, that's the way it was. They would tell us that the bullets that they were firing had caught the huts on fire, and that's why it had burned, although that the grass around the compound and around the hut were burned, but the grass in the middle of the road was not burned. And they would tell us that it had transferred from one to the other, just a basic lie. They would tell us that the helicopter gunships had escorted them there, and they hadn't fired on the village. And a lot of times we couldn't find any evidence of shrapnel in the village. We could not find it. We had no idea, because there was a lot of evidence from talking to the people, from us seeing them leave the airport at a certain time to us seeing wounds that, you know, would only come from helicopter gunships, and we couldn't find evidence. They would collect a lot of the shrapnel themselves. We would go to the IDPs, the internally displaced persons, the refugees in the camps, and ask them if they have evidence of the gunships being used, and they would bring out piles and piles of shrapnel, you know, a meter long by a meter wide, sitting 6 to 12 inches tall, just shrapnel. And they would, that's not from us, that's not ours, I don't know where they got this from. Just bold-faced lies.
There were times when you were able to get physically deeper into the conflict and see what was happening, times when there wasn't a general who was preventing you from going in. Tell us what you were able to see during one of those times and what you think being able to write a report may have accomplished. Start with telling us what you saw.
When we would enter these villages, we would see everything from, you know, the villages being completely burnt down of this village, 20,000, several other. I don't need, you know, it's too hard to try to figure out how many villages I saw burnt down in the 6 months I was there. We would see scores of people who had been killed. We would conduct interviews with women who had been gang raped. Women who had been raped inside an IDP camp that's supposed to be protected by the government, where the Janjaweed would enter the IDP camp and rape the women. We would go into villages where people had been locked in their huts before the huts were set on fire. We would see evidence of torture, people who had their ears cut off, their eyes plucked out, men who had been castrated and left to bleed to death, infants who had been shot by government forces. Those are the things that we would see nearly every day.
So you'd see this and write a report. Who was the report for?
The report was for the African Union.
Now, did the government have any input, the government of Sudan have any input into the reports?
They would sometimes not agree with the conclusions and the recommendations that the African Union team leader would make. And they had an opportunity. A lot of times they wouldn't want to sign the reports. And
Were they supposed to sign the report?
Yes, they're supposed to sign the reports. And what we finally were able to do is we were able to have them sign the report but say that they want to write an addendum to the report. And they could write the addendum on why they didn't agree with the recommendations or agree with the conclusion. We would attach that to the report and then send it up. For example, you know, the report on the village of Marla, where we couldn't find any impacts from the rockets of the gunship, but we found lots of shrapnel. We knew the helicopters were flying over there because a lot of the aid organizations in the UN were reporting that they were flying over that area that day and firing. We saw evidence of the wounds on the people, but the government of Sudan said because there weren't any impacts, then the gunships obviously didn't fire. So that's what they would say.
There weren't any impacts?
We did not find the impacts from the actual rockets that hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you didn't because they used a different type of rocket. Instead of a destroying the hut or destroying a vehicle and a high explosive rocket, they would use an anti-personnel rocket. Each helicopter gunship carries 4 rocket pods, and each rocket pod about 20 rockets. And each of those rockets carry about 500, several hundred at least, of these flechettes, which is basically a 2-inch nail with a little fin on the back like a dart, and it would fire out of the rocket and the nose cone would expel and all these darts would come out like a shotgun round. And they use those a lot of the times, and they would not leave an impact on the ground. They would just cause mass casualties in the civilian population.
When you interviewed the government and the Janjaweed militiamen about the destruction of villages and the massacres of people, if there were times when they didn't deny any responsibility at all, what did they tell you about their motivation?
They would be very, very blunt with us. There was one time in the village of Adwa where we were talking to a large group of the Janjaweed, and they said that some of their camels had been stolen and that they had tracked them down to this village, the Adwa, and that's why they had attacked it, burned half of it down, killed scores of people. And that they had now tracked them to these other villages, and they named them for us. They named, the next 4 villages in a line, and they said that we are going to go to those villages. If we don't get our camels back, we're going to go to those villages. We're going to kill all the people. We're going to burn the village down. We're going to rape all the women, and we're going to steal everything that we can. They told us bluntly, right to our faces, that's what they're going to do. And they did it. They went to the next two villages. The African Union was able to stop the last attack on the final village of the four that they had named. But they went to those next two villages, one of which, the village of Hamada. There were no rebel forces in the village. They surrounded the village, the Janjaweed militia, backed by a reserve police force from the government of Sudan. And they also had helicopter gunships and Antonovs flying over above. They surrounded the entire village with the intent of killing everybody. They killed 107 women and children that day.
Was there a typical pattern that the Janjaweed and the government forces used when they decided to destroy a village?
The majority of the time, an Antonov aircraft would go in, circle over high above. The helicopter gunships would normally come in after that, strafe the village, flying low, firing their weapons at anything that moved. And shortly behind that would follow the government forces and the Janjaweed. And the Janjaweed sometimes were in vehicles of the government, and most of the time they were on their horses and their camels. When they did the attack on the village, the ones that were on camels would dismount, because a camel is not as agile as a horse. So they would dismount their camels, leave them on the outskirts of the town, and the men on horses and the other people on foot would then enter the village with the government forces, killing everybody and attempting to burn everything down. One thing I did leave out is that before any of that happens, we always knew that there was an attack ongoing, because the cell phones would go down. The government of Sudan has control over the cell phones, and before the helicopters fly, before the Antonov takes off, they would shut the cell phone systems down so that there would be no warning from the people that saw the helicopters to the village that was going to be attacked. And we would always try to figure out when that happened, when the cell phones went down, one, how long it was going to be before the helicopters took off, and two, which way they were going, so we could try to get there before them, so we could try to attempt to stop the attack, or to get there as the attack's ongoing, so we could document what was happening.
Did you have a sense at all how much pure sadism was entering into this, as opposed to some sense of revenge that they felt that they could use to justify their actions?
I don't really know about that. I mean, you'd look at these people and you would swear you were looking in the devil's eyes. They have no remorse for what they do. It's pretty chilling to look at these people and say, they can sit here and they can joke with me, and they can sit across the ground as we're sitting on the ground talking to each other, yet they just killed a 2-year-old baby by smashing its head in, and not feel anything by it. It's pretty chilling.
My guest is Brian Steidel. He was an advisor to the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Steidel, and he's a former Marine captain who worked as an advisor for the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. And since returning from Darfur, he's been speaking to members of Congress. He even spoke to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Were there times when you stepped out of your role as monitor and did something that you felt could help in some way?
Yes, we did a number of things, the African Union, the monitors on the ground, to attempt to help the people. We would conduct patrols up a road and notify the aid organizations, the UN, to pass the word that we are leaving at this time to go to this place, and that anybody who wants to go, can follow on with us. We weren't specifically, in our mandate, it doesn't specifically say escorting aid convoys, yet we would put one of our vehicles at the front and one of our vehicles at the end, and they would sit in the middle and we would go up the road. That wasn't specifically in our mandate. We would do that to help them out. One instance specifically was the attack on Adwa. I didn't go to the site. My team did not. But the Janjaweed were on one side of the village attacking and burning, and the African Union teams were on the other. And there were a lot of people that were both walking and lying wounded. And in our mandate, we're not allowed to carry civilians in our helicopters, people not of the African Union. But, you know, we felt it necessary at the time to take these wounded people and get them to medical care. So we loaded up the helicopters with the wounded personnel and did a number of trips back to our camp, where we turned our dining facilities into a triage ward. We had members from the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross. We had members of MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières. We had our medic. In addition to that, our protection force that was with us, the Rwandese at the time, had a medic with them. And also one of our monitors was a former paramedic before he came out, and he was also doing treating. So we pulled everybody we possibly could together to do triage in our dining facility to try to help, you know, save as many people as we could.
Now, you mentioned helping aid convoys by putting one vehicle from the African Union in front of the convoy and another in the rear. But as a monitoring team, you weren't allowed to carry weapons, right?
We were not able to carry weapons. We did have a protection force with us, and their job was to protect our camp and to protect us. So, of course, if we were under attack, if our vehicles were under attack, then they would have been able to respond.
Did you feel like being part of a monitoring team from the African Union made you safer or made you a target?
You know, on both sides. It made us safer and it made us, you know, more of a target. Safer because, you know, from a government standpoint, Governor Sudan's standpoint, and the rebel standpoint, they knew that the eyes of the world were on us and what we were doing, and that there was a lot of countries that were involved in the AU's mission there. And if they had attacked us or done something to us, then they would have, you know, been seen as the bad guys from the entire world. Now, on the other side, the Janjaweed militia, of course, are not party to the ceasefire agreement. And the government considers them not theirs. So they would, on a number of times, take shots at us when we would get too close. They didn't want to talk to us. They'd shoot at us to warn us off. And also on that side, I would have to say that the villagers, again, are not part of the ceasefire. Many of them are armed. And sometimes they would become frustrated with the African Union. They wouldn't understand what our mandate was, wouldn't understand what our limitations were. There was one incident where the village I just spoke of, Labado, had been attacked, and the next village online was Muhajiria, and my team had showed up there, and the people of the village wanted us to go find 85 individuals from the village of Labado who apparently had been taken by the government of Sudan and the Arab militia to some wadi or a riverbed nearby, and some had been executed, and the others apparently were lying under the trees. And we couldn't get any more information from them except that it was in a nearby wadi. This is, you know, a vast, vast land, and we needed to know at least a cardinal direction. They said north, and we said, okay, how far? They couldn't give us the information. We said, well, we're going to go and we're going to look for them. We're going to go circle above, and they said, no, you're going to stay here as insurance, and we're going to take your helicopter, and we're going to go get our people and bring them back here. And so it took a few minutes. Probably 15 minutes for us to talk to the villagers, talk to the rebels that were there, separate from the villagers, and convince them, the rebel groups, the SLA and the GEM, to convince the villagers that we needed to go to do our mission.
How frustrating was that to be there to help them, and then they want to almost hold you hostage and take your helicopter?
Well, it was very frustrating, but you have to look at the situation from their eyes. You have to see that village after village after village has been attacked. These people have been driven from their homes. They've been in an IDP camp and then driven out of an IDP camp and then been in another IDP camp and then been driven out of that one. And they're extremely frustrated. And up until, you know, very recently, I would say the end of January, the African Union has been unable to stop the fighting. They have been unable to protect the civilians. The rebels have been unable to protect the civilians because they are extremely, they're outnumbered, and they don't have the firepower to defend the government attacks.
Now, since returning from Darfur, you've met with various senators, including Senator Brownback, and you've met with Condoleezza Rice. What is your ambition in speaking with them?
Nobody has seen a government of Sudan helicopter attacking a village and been able to come back and talk about it. I have. Nobody's seen, you know, these villages being burnt down in front of their eyes and seeing government of Sudan soldiers looting, you know, shooting the locks off of shops, going in, taking stuff out, and coming, you know, and stealing stuff out of a store. Well, I have. And that's what I hope to do is to give them a first-hand account of what is happening on the ground, not second-hand, third-hand stories, but this is what I have seen. Here are my pictures. You know, look at this. These are the atrocities that are happening on the ground. Now, we need to try to make this more of a priority. I think that we need to take the next step and try to put more pressure on the UN and the rest of the countries in the world to do what's right.
Do you think you will ever go back to Darfur?
No, I do not believe I'll ever be able to get a visa to go to Sudan, which, you know, I had a lot of really good friends there. There's some very good people in Sudan, and I would like to see them again, but I don't believe I'll ever be able to go back there. And if I did get a visa to go to Sudan, I don't believe that it would be safe for me to return to Sudan at this point.
Well, Brian Steidel, good luck to you, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Brian Steidel is a former Marine captain who worked with the African Union monitoring team in Darfur from last September to February. More on Sudan in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble, from TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org, and from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD, with next-generation diesel technology, emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we discuss the history of the crisis in Darfur and why the UN Security Council has been deadlocked on how to respond. We talk with John Prendergast, who has 20 years of experience working in conflict resolution in Africa and is an advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The UN has called the mass killing, rape, and destruction of villages in Darfur crimes against humanity. But the UN Security Council remains deadlocked over what to do about it, and today postponed a vote on a Sudan resolution. My guest, John Prendergast, has been working on conflict resolution in Africa for about 20 years and is a special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. His most recent trip to Sudan was in January. What have been the big sticking points at the UN Security Council over its resolution on what to do in Sudan?
Fortunately, there are layers of complexity in the deliberations in New York now. The first issue, probably the most contentious one, is whether the crisis in Darfur and the perpetrators of the crimes against humanity that have been committed there will be referred or not to the International Criminal Court, to the ICC. And the French lead a European contingent in demanding that that referral be made. The U.S. Bush administration famously is viscerally opposed to the ICC and, of course, opposed to its referral, even though the U.S. has been out front on the demand that there be some form of accountability for the crimes that have been committed.
I think the U.S. doesn't want to be a party to the International Criminal Court because it's afraid that Americans might someday be tried in it.
Particularly the Defense Department. When I worked in the Clinton administration, this was an issue that transcended both Democrat and Republican parties, that the concern exists that American troops serving in peacekeeping missions abroad could be brought up on charges. I don't think that's possible personally, but enough people do that it became a very strong concern within the Clinton administration and has become a matter of ideology in the Bush administration in terms of opposition to the court.
So has the American refusal to sign any resolution that includes the International Criminal Court, has that been the major sticking point?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest one in terms of the first step of getting a resolution. It's related very directly to the fact that the U.S. is strongly supporting the imposition of targeted sanctions against regime officials in Khartoum, whereas the Europeans are very strongly opposed to that. So you have what is basically a standoff between the Europeans and Americans over both the ICC, which the Europeans support, and the targeted sanctions, which the Americans support. But lingering in the background, of course, and smiling broadly, are the Chinese and the Russians, who both are willing, or at least say they are willing at this point, to veto any bill that comes out, any resolution that comes out demanding sanctions or referral to the ICC. So there are two layers of obstacles we're dealing with here on the issues of accountability, the European-American divide, as well as the threat of the Chinese/Russian veto.
Now, does oil in Sudan have anything to do with how members of the Security Council are likely to vote?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with it. I think that if you follow the money trail here, you see that four out of the five members of the UN Security Council, the U.S. being the lone exception, are invested heavily or lightly in the Sudan oil sector. Four out of the five, in addition, are selling arms or brokering arms deals to the government of Sudan. So we have fairly vested economic interests that, again, if the U.S. doesn't muster the political will to break the logjam, we simply won't get meaningful multilateral action on Darfur because of these economic interests and the political issues related to sovereignty.
So if this UN Security Council resolution passes, what would it do to help stop the crimes against humanity in Darfur?
It would simply be a first step, I think. It's a very weak resolution, by the way. And even if it did pass in its strongest version, it would just be a parted solution to the international community's necessary response to the crimes that have been committed in Sudan. However, if they did pass it, a fairly robust version of the current resolution, then I think it would begin to alter the calculations of the regime in Khartoum. At this point, 2 years have passed in which what the Bush administration calls a genocide has unfolded in Western Sudan. During those 2 years, not one punitive measure has been imposed on the orchestrator of these crimes, the Sudanese government. And so once you start slapping scarlet letters on the regime, on the officials of the regime, through targeted sanctions like asset freezes and travel bans and an arms embargo, then you start to affect their calculations. This is not the Taliban, this is not Saddam Hussein, they're not looking to go down with the ship. These guys want to be players in the international system. If they are finally called out in a specific way, in a punitive way, their behavior will be altered rapidly. It is terribly unfortunate that we haven't been able to muster the international political will to slap such a minor sanction as a travel ban on these guys, because I think it would have a very rapid impact on their actions on the ground in Darfur.
My guest is John Prendergast, special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. We'll talk more about Sudan after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Prendergast, special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. He's been working on conflict resolution in Africa for 20 years. We're talking about Sudan. The civil war in Sudan recently ended. A long civil war was recently ended through negotiation. How is that civil war connected, and how isn't it connected to the massacres in Darfur?
There are multiple poles of opposition to the government in Khartoum. Of course, the regime there in the capital is a minority clique that took power in a military coup in 1989, represent a very small percentage of the country. And the southern rebellion, southern-based rebellion, is the longest-running armed element of that opposition. In fact, the war went on for 21 years and was only settled 2 months ago after a very, very long and concerted diplomatic effort. Darfur is connected to that very directly because in two ways. One, it's a symptom of a larger malaise in Sudan, which this small clique of people in the center of the country control most of the power and wealth, so most of the periphery wants a slice of the pie, and they'll do quite a lot, either militarily or politically, to challenge that status quo. And so, of course, the people in Darfur, the people in the east, the people in the far north, share the sentiments of the southerners that they're being cut out. But secondly, I think the Darfur conflict is connected to the south because the way the negotiations unfolded in the south is that they didn't allow, the negotiators, including the United States, didn't allow any other group in Sudan to be part of the negotiations. They just had a bilateral forum between the government and the southern-based rebels. So the Darfurians, who wanted to be part and parcel of these negotiations, who were cut out, basically judged themselves to have one option, which is to shoot their way into a negotiating process. So they started their rebellion in early 2003, the armed aspect of their rebellion, and the rest is history.
I'll confess, I'm still really confused about what the fighting in Darfur is really about. I often read that it's about the Arab migrants versus the black farmers, but it seems like it's also really about larger political issues. So would you give it your best shot at explaining what the fighting in Darfur is really about, what the bottom line is?
I think in the first instance, all these wars are very complicated, but in the first instance, the people that were able to move and create an actual armed rebellion were motivated by the fact that they're being completely cut out of the political and economic structure of the country, that there is a pie that's been cut up, and they're not part of it. And there's a lot of money flowing in Sudan these days with the oil, and the power commensurate with that money is very attractive. And people in Darfur see their chances to have a piece of that slipping away. And that certainly was a partial motivator. But I also think there are underlying ethnic and regional and other social elements to the reason why the war began. There certainly is a history of rivalry between communities, between Arab and non-Arab communities in Darfur. But those rivalries were being stoked more and more over the last decade by the government because it has maintained power, like most dictatorships do, through a policy of divide and rule. And when the rebellion began, which was a rebellion largely of non-Arab peoples against the government, it was a very easy decision for the government to say, okay, if that's where it's going to come from, then let's arm the most heinous sort of radical element of the Arab community, which is the Janjaweed militias, which represent a very, very small minority of sentiment of the Arab people in Western Sudan. Let's arm them to go after these people and do the kind of job, the military, and carry out a military strategy of counterinsurgency, which became, in effect, genocidal. And I think that that the combination of these political and economic factors, along with this history of social division, were the principal kind of ingredients to the conflict cocktail in Darfur.
You know, civil war is one thing, but when you get to near genocide or what the UN calls crimes against humanity, I mean, that's a level of brutality and sadism that's like above and beyond civil war. Do you have any ideas of what could help explain the unconscionable brutality that has been going on there?
There actually is an internal rationale to the actions the government has perpetrated during the last 2 years. They very clearly wanted to send a message in the context of their military operations to other parts of the country. That message was, look here, if you want to oppose us militarily, this is what you're going to get. So there was a predisposition to a very, very strong incommensurate response to the rebellion that unfolded in Darfur. But more importantly, I think, the oldest trick in the book, the oldest strategy in the book of war, is when you fight a counterinsurgency campaign, you drain the water to catch the fish. You destroy the asset base, the civilian population base of a rebel group, and you ensure that that rebel group no longer has an ability to gain safe haven, ability to resupply itself from a sympathetic civilian population. So what the government of Sudan did was conduct a military counterinsurgency strategy that literally wiped out the people from under the rebellion. And they stripped out the non-Arab population of Darfur and forced them into these what are effectively concentration camps, these displaced camps throughout Western Sudan, thus denying the rebels their ability to move around, which crippled their military capacity. So it was actually a very successful military strategy. You know, and 200 or 300 years ago, people probably would have yawned and said, what a nice campaign. But now we have such a thing as an international human rights movement. We have international law. We have laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, and, of course, the Genocide Convention. And the Sudanese government has grotesquely violated all of those. And unfortunately, as we've already discussed, the international community, the response of the international community is largely what it was 200 or 300 years ago, a big yawn. We haven't done nearly remotely what is necessary to combat or counter these horrible crimes.
Something else that's happened is Rwanda. Members of the international community were saying we can never let anything like that happen again, and yet what's happening in Sudan is similar. So what lessons do you think were learned from Rwanda and or could have been learned from Rwanda?
You know, we learn a lot. We never apply it. I think that that what's happened during the last decade is the international community, particularly the United States, has become more and more adept at providing humanitarian assistance, what are largely Band-Aids over these crises. We spend more and more money, and we congratulate ourselves for how generous we are, either in the aftermath of the things or even while they're happening. But with respect to the actual cause of these humanitarian catastrophes, the horrible human rights abuses that are perpetrated on civilian populations, we have done not one iota different. Our actions are entirely consistent with what we did in Rwanda, which is a big zero. And I think, you know, we have a symbolic force. There was a symbolic force in Rwanda, as we all know, during those 100 days. For the last year of the 2 years of the crisis in Darfur, we've had a largely symbolic force
You're talking about the African Union?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, I think we know how to do lip service very well. I think that's the principal lesson, is we've learned to immediately talk about things, immediately say how concerned we are, to even call genocide by its rightful name, which, of course, the Bush administration famously did 6 months ago. But we simply are unwilling. It's not unable. It's not incapable. We are unwilling to then expend the political capital necessary to create the kind of policy that would actually confront the killers, that would actually end the killing.
You describe the African Union as a largely symbolic force in Darfur. Do you think that the problem with the African Union's force is its size or its mandate?
I think the problem is both the size and the mandate, and the problem is that they are not backed up sufficiently by the United States and the European Union. The mandate is inadequate. It needs to be strengthened. It needs to be, the objective of the force needs to be the protection of civilians. That needs to be the purpose that we are about right now, and it is not that. Secondly, I was stunned by a newspaper account that I saw earlier this week that the French government, in its application to host the 2012 Olympics in France, is willing to put 41,000 police officers in Paris alone, while at the same time the entire world is not yet able to put 2,000 troops on the ground in Darfur, a region the size of the entire country of France. I mean, the disparities just slap you in the face in our choices that we make as a society and as a global community. So I think that the Darfurians are largely left to fend for themselves. And the African Union force, I have no doubt about the intentions of the African Union. It wants to do something good. It wants to help the people. It wants to protect the people. But it's not backed by the international community, particularly by the Security Council, to do what it needs to be doing right now, which is protecting people.
My guest is John Prendergast, Special Advisor to the President of the International Crisis Group. We'll talk more about Sudan after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Prendergast, Special Advisor to the President of the International Crisis Group. He's been working on conflict resolution in Africa for 20 years. We're talking about Sudan. In the 90s, the Sudan had become a haven for terrorists. Bin Laden lived there after leaving Saudi Arabia before going to Afghanistan. Is it still a haven for terrorists? And does the chaos and the violence and the crimes against humanity there now affect it as a place for terrorists?
I think there are two really important points to make about terrorism in Sudan. First is that the world's reaction, particularly led by the United States, to Sudan's role as a supporter of terrorism, makes the point about why aggressive and robust action now could stop the crimes against humanity in Darfur. Because in the 90s, in the mid-1990s to late 1990s, the U.S. led a campaign through the United Nations Security Council to isolate the government of Sudan for its support for international terrorism. Because of very small measures being taken through the Security Council, the Sudanese government changed its behavior almost completely with respect to terrorist organizations. It kicked Bin Laden out of the country. It dismantled the al-Qaeda infrastructure that had been constructed during the last 6 years, from 90 to 96, and it cut a lot of the ties that it had with a number of other terrorist organizations and individuals. There's empirical evidence that if it's pressured, the government will change its behavior. That has a very direct relevance to the situation in Darfur. The second point that needs to be made about terrorism in Sudan is that the United States' ongoing relationship with the Sudanese government to try to address counterterrorism issues has led us to have relationships with individuals in the Sudanese government hierarchy who are directly responsible for orchestrating the crimes that have been committed in Darfur. And I worry that the extent of our relationship on counterterrorism with the Sudanese government has in fact obstructed the United States from taking more bold and assertive action against the regime for the crimes that it's committed in Darfur. And you can't prove intent on the part of the U.S. government or motivation, but the empirical evidence exists that the U.S. has been very soft. Outside of rhetoric, the U.S. has been very soft in its actual dealings with the Khartoum regime and the actions that it has undertaken in Darfur.
What do you think the international community could do to stop the killing in Darfur?
I think it's really, really clear. Rarely do you have, as an African advocate, in my 20 years working on these issues, such an obvious answer. We need to buttress the African Union force immediately. We need to support it with a stronger mandate, and we need a lot more troops. And NATO needs to get involved and help with the expansion of that force rather rapidly. On the flip side of the same coin, we need to focus on accountability. There has to be an agreement in the Security Council or elsewhere that targeted sanctions, be imposed on this government, that their case be referred to some form of tribunal. The ICC is the right answer, but it may be impossible because of U.S. opposition. But there has to be some accountability for the crimes that have been committed. If you get those two rolling down the track in the right direction, we will see a very rapid turnaround in the situation in Darfur.
When was your last trip to Darfur?
I went about a month and a half ago with Paul Rusesabagina, the main character from Hotel Rwanda, and we also brought Don Cheadle, who acted as Paul in the movie, and we brought Nightline with us, and we went across from the Chadian refugee camps into Darfur, and explored around and tried and interviewed people all throughout Chad, the refugee camps, and in Darfur. So it was about mid-January was the last there.
Now, you were also there over the summer. Had the situation changed much?
I think it's gotten much worse. I think the biggest threat now is that we're looking at the possibility of famine in certain locations in Darfur. And I think, in my experience, the only thing worse that you could possibly contemplate than genocide is genocide topped off by famine. So I think we are we're approaching a moment in Darfur that could get much, much worse because of the food security situation.
I'm interested in what you think the impact of the movie Hotel Rwanda has been. And are you ambivalent at all? I mean, on the one hand, it's wonderful that the movie has raised awareness of what's happening, you know, of what genocide means. But at the same time, are you frustrated that, well, that's what it takes? You have to make a major Hollywood motion picture with, you know, a star of the stature of Don Cheadle in it.
3 weeks ago, I've been working on these issues for 20 years ago, and 3 weeks ago, my mom called me and said, well, your dad and I just went to the movie Hotel Rwanda. We finally understand what you've been doing all these years. So, well, of course, it's a little frustrating that it requires a major motion picture. But nevertheless, it's there. The cards have been dealt. And I think this is a very significant hand that has been given to all of us who are struggling over these years, trying to bring about attention and reaction by the international community to these crises around Africa and more broadly in the world. And I think Don Cheadle and Paul Rusesabagina together create a tandem of almost moral force that is really, really I've rarely seen before. Paul is traveling all over the world raising money for his foundation and raising people's awareness of what is going on in Sudan today. And Don and I are writing a book together now. We just started about the situation in Sudan. And so there's a great commitment by both of those guys after the experiences that they've both gone through to really make a difference.
John Prendergast, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
John Prendergast is special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. Earlier, we heard from Brian Steidel, a former Marine captain who worked with the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. You can see some of Steidel's photographs of Darfur on our website at freshair.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Karen Armstrong, the author of several best-selling books on the history of the world's religions. We'll talk about why she entered the convent at the age of 17 and why she left 7 years later, feeling she had failed to find God. Her memoir, The Spiral Staircase, has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.